wrote her an introduction to no avail. Well, it's good to see you, folks. Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And a member of the primary purpose group in Southern Pines, North Carolina. Same one as old folks. And it's good to be here. Good to be with a bunch of old friends. This is like a family reunion for me. I can't believe it, but I think this is one piece of Virginia that I've never really hung out in. That it's a beautiful place. My God, it's great. I never saw so many cattle in my life. I thought this was horse country. Yeah, they got mixed up pretty bad somewhere because those are not horses out there. Or else they're the ugliest horses I've ever seen. So it really is good to be here. I appreciate you guys doing this. And we had a good time coming up here with Susie and old folks. Susie was the navigator. Now, if you don't believe alcoholics make goofy decisions, remember what she said earlier? She went for a little walk in Seattle, Washington, and wound up in Houston, Texas. And we got her navigating a trip to here. It was an interesting trip. We had a lot of side trips with it. But we had a good time. It was so exciting, the old man couldn't even go to sleep. And he'll normally do that even if he's driving. So it really is a pleasure to be here. Beautiful day and a good crowd and fellowship that we can all appreciate. And what we're doing is just swapping our stories. Yeah, sometimes we refer to AA, to people in AA that talk to a group as speakers. And I just think it's a wrong term. We're not speakers. We're storytellers. That's what we do. We tell our stories. If you want to see an AA group shut down, start making a speech to them. And you watch what happens, man. You'll get stonewalled in a heartbeat. So, anyway, I am delighted to be here, and I want to share with you in a general way what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. And I tell you that I am grateful to be here. I walked into my first AA meeting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on the 2nd of February, 1957. And by the grace of God and a whole lot of good work and some hard sponsorship, I've been sober ever since. And that is an unbelievable thing. If anybody ever told me I'd even be walking at this age, I'd have found that very hard to believe. And then walking straight and sober and frisky, well, I don't know, but I might go into line if I say much more about that. But I'm still friskier than I ever thought I'd be. And I'll just tell you one little editorial sounding thing that I found to be true. That, some people tell me that they get worn out, that they're working hard today, they get worn out, and just get tired and all that. That has not been my experience. I've been active in Alcoholics Anonymous ever since the day I walked in. I didn't start making talks the first day I walked in, but they helped me, let me help with the chairs. I even got a chance to do that here today. Well, no problem at all. I had two or three guys step back just so they could watch me haul those chairs over there. So I've been active, and I've never known but one speed, and that's wide open. And here I am 53 years later, and I am absolutely as frisky as I've ever been. I've got as much imagination as I've ever had, as active as I've ever been, do as many things, and mine still works. Whatever nimbleness it had before, it's still there. And so if anybody tells you that you'll burn out, the only time I see people burn out is usually people never were lit up is the ones who get burned up. But what happens with me is that the more active I get, the more energy I get. And so I get pumped. I don't get tired. I get pumped. And so I am pleased to share with you a bit here. When I came into AA, I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic. I was 24 years old. So you can tell by just doing simple math that means I'm now 61. Or somewhere in that neighborhood. But I truly didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I thought I was too young. Never had believed. I'd been diagnosed as an alcoholic or a problem drinker or drunk by everybody who ever captured me. Didn't make any difference whether it was a deputy sheriff, psychiatrist, a minister, or whatever. Anybody can ask me. I've never been diagnosed as anything other than, my God, you sure drink a lot. You're a problem drinker. You're an alcoholic. You're drunk. On and on and on. Never meant a thing to me whatsoever. And so when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no real sense of identification. I listened to speakers. I never heard a single speaker that I identified with till I was in AA 2 years. And when I finally identified with somebody, he was as different from me as anybody ever met. And I'm very, very glad that that happened, even though it was 2 years. When I nobody meant to do it, but when I went in, I was the youngest guy that I ever met in AA anywhere for several years. I swear to God, I got so tired of people telling me how lucky I was to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, yeah, what a thrill. Yeah, yeah. And I remember one day I had a guy kind of pat me on the head and telling me how lucky I was. And he said, asked me how old I was. I said, 24. He said, do you realize that at your age, if you really work this thing, you could get as much as 50 years in this program? And when he said it, he kind of eyes rolled back in his head. You know, he just in rapture. And what is he so thrilled about? I'm going to be in a geriatric ward for the rest of my life. And I was not exactly thrilled. And so it was great, you know, when the first guy came in the program that I saw that was younger than me. I wanted to kiss him. I was so glad to see that guy. Man, he didn't stay long enough, though. But anyway, stayed long enough to let me see there's another one. Were you waving at me? Okay. I was going to tell her if you were. Watch you. But it was a kind of a lost place, you know, in AA. When I sat in meetings and listened to people tell their stories, you know, that I know now what they're telling, that sometimes you tell a story and I mean, you don't necessarily lie, but sometimes you've got to round it off a little bit, you know, just so it'll fit well and flow nicely, you know, because if you just get into harsh, stern terms, you don't, it doesn't go anywhere, you know, so you got to just sort of liven it up a little bit. And I know that's what it was now, but when I'd come in, I'd listen to somebody say, I stayed drunk around the clock every day for 40 years. Well, I mean, my God, on my first day in sobriety, I knew better than that. I mean, ain't nobody going to stay solid drunk 40 years, for God's sake. And I know he's probably making a point, not very well with me, because he's not good even thinking those terms. Been married to the same woman 5 times. 1 month. Yeah. Making a point. Never know sure what it was. But anyway, you just listen to that kind of stuff. And awfully hard to identify with that. You know, the heart and soul of Alcoholics Anonymous is about how we identify, not how we educate each other or inform each other. It's about how we identify. Yeah, there's a place in the book, I could recite it, but I'll just make it up a little bit, and it'll come close enough, you'll know what I'm talking about, if you take a look at Dr. Bob's story. And somewhere, either right toward the front or right toward the end, he's talking about, and I think everybody knows who we're talking about, Dr. Bob, the co-founder. And what he's talking about in this portion of his story was the experience that he had with Bill Wilson in the gatehouse at the Cyberling Estate in Akron. When Bill was desperate and he needed to talk to a drunk, and they captured Dr. Bob. And I never had liked calling him Dr. Bob. He's a proctologist. I'm not even sure that's a doctor. I mean, who would go into that for a specialty, for God's sake? Anyway, he said he was, so we'll take your word for it. But Bill wound up with him, you know, and they captured him. He had him over to the gatehouse. And he had said he was a very busy physician, so he didn't have but 15 minutes, and that 15 minutes turned into probably 6 hours. And when he got through, and this is what he's writing about, and you can check this out in the book, essentially what he says is, Now, he's a learned man. He's a scientist. He's a physician. He's a trained man. He is used to dealing with heavy subjects. And he said, what was it about this man, Bill Wilson, this old broken-down stockbroker, that's different from every other person that I talk with, of all kinds of people at every strata of society? What was different about him? And then he answered his own question. He said, it was because he talked with me of his own experience. This is what I did. And he was the first human being I had ever heard who talked that way. And an identification happened that day that was never to end. You know, they remained friends for good God years, many, many years, 40 years or so. And according to both of them, they never had a harsh word, because that identification occurred. My belief is that the principle that was established that day became the basic tenet of Alcoholics Anonymous. That we're not people who just have similar experiences. We're people who have been broken and healed in the same place. And that's what we do, is identify with that process. It's the heart and soul of it. It's why we tell our stories. It's also probably one of the greatest indicators of why singleness of purpose is important. Truly important. Because you don't identify with experiences you haven't had. And just trying to be a nice guy doesn't bridge the gap. So very, very important, that thing that was laid out. And over time, that's what happened with me, is that I finally heard somebody that I identified with. And when I did, he was as unlike me as anybody I'd ever met. He was a twerpy-looking guy, I swear to God. He was from Detroit. I was in Michigan. I was in the same kind of walled enclosure that the old folks was. And this guy, I always felt so sorry for him. I think they lied to him in Detroit and said, we're going on a cookout. And so he gets in the car, and the next thing he's getting ushered in to a maximum custody penitentiary. And that was the scariest human I have ever seen. He was so scared. He kept looking all the time. You see if anybody's behind him. You know, thought he was going to get captured, yanked into somebody's cell or something. I don't know what even. But he was scared to death. And they coerced him. I mean, coerced him into speaking. He didn't want to speak. He didn't want to be there. Never mind saying how to do. He didn't want to do anything except get out. But they outnumbered him, so they just pushed him on up to the podium. What are you going to do? I mean, here you stand. And he was so scared, his voice came out in a falsetto. It was like, remember Tiny Tim? Yes. I wish I could forget that sucker. Anyway, he just had a grating kind of a way. And this guy, his voice came out like that squeaky little thing. And he talked for just a few minutes. And thank God for that guy. I didn't identify with any of his experiences, nor would he have with me. He'd never been in jail in his life. I don't know what's wrong with him, but he just didn't make the muster. And so he never made jail. I don't know if he ever drove by one. He acted like he had. But what he told was his story. And what he described was the first time I heard alcoholism described in terms that really identify the illness. And it's not Wild West stories. And it's not how many times I went to jail, how many cars I wrecked, how many times I've been married. Those are indicators. You know, I know one time I got married to a lady I didn't know. I mean, I had even met, to my knowledge. Kind of like Susie was talking about. I'm glad I didn't meet her drinking. I woke up and there was this lady was there laying right beside me. And I said something like, and who are you, my dear? And something like that. And she said, I'm Mrs. Ivester. And I said, uh-oh. You done it now, big guy. You have flat done it. And I had. And it was legal. She had the papers to prove it. And she got the money to prove it, too. But anyway, that's bad liquor. So anyway, there was a lot of weird stuff that was in there. But that identification with somebody that had not to do with all of the circumstances of alcoholism, but the reality. And what this guy was describing, not in eloquent terms, but you could just hear it in his voice. He was describing what it's like to die on the inside. Can look very successful on the outside. Can have all the stuff in the world. But when you die on the inside, it makes no difference. Now, as he talked about how he lived in fear, omnipresent fear of everything and nothing. And I could identify with that. Yeah, that was the first person I ever identified with, and he couldn't have found a more opposite person in the world, because he talked about the reality of alcoholism and not the circumstances of alcoholism. And so that's who I was. I was 24 years old. My history was... I'll just allude to it and spin on, because I really want to talk about the process of recovery a bit. But just to allude to it, I was a guy that started drinking as a youngster, but like a lot of people do, just by sipping drinks that I found around the house. Got into my first serious drinking when I was about 16. I mean, I did some of that behind the gym at the school dances and stuff like that. But first serious drinking when I was 16. And when I really took the first serious drink, I wasn't an instant alcoholic, nor an alcoholic at all. I was a guy for whom booze did something special to me. It changed my life. It changed how I felt. You know, I'd always been a kind of an awkward, twerpy. I hid it well, but I was always a kind of a twerpy kind of kid, you know, that I had a knack for leadership. You know, people would follow me even when I didn't know where I was going. They'd just come on, and we'd go. And so I was like that, but I always was lacking something that made me comfortable with people. I was always an isolated person. I never would let anybody get close to me. Now, you know, I might get into some kind of a relationship, but I never would really make a committed relationship with anybody. I'd have buddies and I'd have friends. I've never made a committed relationship to a woman in my life until I met the woman I'm married to today. That'll be 42 years this July. But that's the first committed relationship. And it wasn't that I was phony or unwilling. I was unable. Because of just the way I grew up, that I just had this kind of a wall against letting anybody into my life. I didn't trust them. I didn't want them to get close. Didn't want them to get to know who I was. You know, I always like to keep that private to myself. And so I made a lot of noise. Now, you would have never known I was like that if you'd have seen me in action, because I looked anything but shy. I was always the guy that was the life of the party. Town clown. Yeah, that wasn't a natural role, but it was a pretty good role. And I kind of enjoyed doing that, but I had to make myself do it. I had to, had that kind of a thing of just sort of being the wild guy. You know, my street name was Steve Brody. And if you're old enough, you can remember Steve Brody was a daredevil. And his moment of fame was when he jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge in New York. He was the first guy to ever do that and survive. And that was my street name, because that's what people thought I'd do. If they jabbed me enough, I'd jump. I didn't. They gave up too quick. But anyway, that's what I'm looking at. I looked at a life like that. That was... not only filled with all that kind of awkwardness with life, but an inability to live life very effectively. I started going to jail when I was quite young. And not because of the criminal. I, honest to God, have never committed a predatory criminal act in my life. Never have. Now, I lived in the middle of it, and I did a lot of things that the untrained eye would have considered crime. But if you really knew the facts now, it wouldn't be a crime. It was, well, sometimes people get confused about that, and they'll put the handcuffs on you anyway. But it wasn't really, I was a guy that just bounced through life real quick. I was a guy that I always had a home bar. You know, like I'm a home group guy. I've been talking with some people here today about home groups and how important they are. I guess that's part of the roots of why I put so much premium on a home group. I am a member of a home group. I belong. That is my group. That's not where I hang out and just go to meetings. That's where I do my work. My most fundamental work is done in that home group. And so I'm a good believer in that kind of a deal. And home group is where I feel secure and in place and have a really ready kind of an involvement, anything going on. And I was the kind of guy that needed a home group, a home bar. And I always had one. Now, they weren't the kind that would be doing a lot of fancy advertising. But I always made a home bar a place where I was comfortable. First one I ever had was a place down in my state. It was called Rats, R-A-T-S, Rats. Nobody ever asked why they called it Rats. I mean, it just looked like that would be a good name for it. The guy that owned it was called Rat, and that's probably why they called it that. He looked like a rat, big old pointy nose, beady eyes. And Rats was I'm not even sure honky-tonk isn't a little too dignified for that. It was just one of those places that we used to be famous for down south. I mean, they were just some dump of a place out in the middle of nowhere. This one was at least on a highway, but it was a bad place. Now, you could walk in there any time, day or night, morning, noon, or night, see the same thing. It'd be somebody playing the jukebox and trying to stagger around and dance on the floor out there. Somebody fighting over in another corner. Somebody sleeping on the pool table. Somebody else trying to shoot pool. And dogs running through barking and all this. Somebody trying to make out in a booth. Somebody throwing up over here. It was a wonderful place. When I'd walk in there, I'd feel home at last. I'd fit in. Nobody ever got thrown out of Rats in the history of the place. Worst thing happened to you, rats get thrown in. No, not out. Nobody ever got raided. I mean, where would you take somebody to punish them for being in Rats? Good God, leave them alone. They beat themselves to death. So, always had a home bar. You know, a place that you need a place where folks know you and they don't consider your behavior to be abnormal. That's just, well, that's old Tom. Don't worry about him. He lays there all the time. Yeah, so, and I had another one after I became rich and famous. And I was in a place, in fact, they thought I was working there. I really wasn't. I was drinking there. But it was a bar, and I was trying to serve up, let the customers have some. I got most of it, but they got a little bit. And one night I was off duty in there, and I must have been tired or something. I normally didn't sit in a booth. They're uncomfortable. But apparently, for some reason, I was sitting in a booth, and when I got drunk, I used to get slick. You know, I mean, I had a policeman tell me one time that he hated to lock me up worse than anybody he ever arrested. And I said, why? He said, well, it's like trying to pick up a ferret, you know. Said, when I pick you up, you just slide out, you know. He said, my God, I have to get two or three of us to lift you. Yeah. And well, I said, I'm sorry about that, but I was that way. I just get slick. And so that night I was sitting in that booth, and apparently I got pretty slick, and slid under, you know, out of the chair, and came to, I'm under the booth. And I had an instant reaction of fear because I'm locked up in a bar at 3 o'clock in the morning. It was a fleeting moment of fear. And then I thought, my God, I'm locked up in this bar. I'd always had this notion of what it would be like to start at one end of the bar and drink something out of every bottle. I don't know how far I got. And I made a valiant effort. Next morning, they found me this old thing they call shuffleboards. I don't even know if they still mess with those things or not. I never even know why they did anyway. I mean, just all you do, put a drunk at each end and slide something back and forth. I never even know if it's a game to it. They just did it until they fell over. And so they found me the next morning in the fetal position up on the shuffleboard. And good thing about a home bar, I didn't call the police. They said, somebody get him out of here. So anyway, I was a home bar type of guy. And I was a fellow that just got into a lot of trouble with booze. When I first started hearing about alcoholism, I thought if I had it, I must have had it all my life. I don't really think so. You know, I'm somebody who believes that alcoholism is a genuine illness. The book says the main problem is in the mind. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. But there's another side to it that defines alcoholism. When I went into the military, I did that just to get out of Dodge, you know. But when I got in the military, that's where I really developed alcoholism. And certainly I didn't know it at the time because I was extremely drunk all the time. And I would not notice stuff like developing alcoholism. I drank as much as I could before I was alcoholic. And didn't slack up when I became alcoholic. I just continued on. And so I wouldn't have noticed a little nuance like crossing the line into alcoholism. But the best I can tell is in my 18th year where I lost the ability to control my drinking. I know many of you have heard me say this, and I hope you'll always hear me say it as long as I'm making noise, that the best definition of alcoholism I've ever heard is the one in the third chapter, about halfway down the page, where it says in one little sentence, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. And that's exactly what happened to me, that I lost the ability to control my drinking. I certainly didn't know it at the time, but when I got sober, looked back, best I can tell, was somewhere in that 18th year, is whatever it is that happens, happened. And I lost the ability. If I took a drink, I couldn't predict what I would do, how much I would drink, what I would drink. I drank hydraulic brake fluid one time. Didn't mean to. But a Yankee bootlegger sold me that stuff and told me it was some exotic new liquor of some sort. Took the money. And it was good brake fluid because it locked me tighter than a drum for a week. I mean, man, I couldn't move. I got to, anyway. That's not why I'm an alcoholic. You know, I lost the ability. If I took a drink, I could not predict what I would do, and that was to be the story of my life from that point on. It is not a matter of the stuff that happened; it's about what happened to me on the inside. And because the stuff that happened on the outside, like waking up married to somebody I don't know, that's not an indicator of alcoholism. It's an indicator of stupidity and being awfully drunk. But that's not necessarily alcoholism. I've known people who've known or married six or eight women, most of whom they didn't know. Probably not alcoholics. They need some kind of help, but I don't know exactly what it is. And how many times I've been in jail? I have no earthly idea how many times I've been in jail. I like to think I've been in just about the right number. Because I haven't been in one since I discovered it was enough. And thank God, I hope I never do. And I don't have to, as long as I do what I'm doing. That doesn't define alcoholism. I know good, sincere, genuine, no questions asked alcoholics who've never been in jail. I don't know where they went. I mean, I don't know how you can possibly be an alcoholic and not go to jail. But some manage it, somehow or other. Certainly not their fault when I listen to their stories, but there's caught and uncaught. I was on the caught side. I was in. Go ahead, anyway. I'm going to get out of this thing. But all of that's happened when I was in my teens, early 20s. I got bounced out of the service just like the old folks did. I called in after a bunch of times and read the Riot Act for the last time and said I was given an undesirable discharge. And what it said on it was just about what he said this morning, that it said, undesirable discharge, unfit for military service, alcoholism. And I'm 20 years old. Now, you know about how much that meant? Nothing whatsoever. I thought, free at last. Man, I'm out of this thing. And so I'm out. And all I did was just take it with me and then went hog wild on the outside. The only difference was there was no regimented living then, and I just went and hit the street. I wanted to be anybody, anywhere other than where I was. It didn't matter. I didn't have any goal or destination in mind. I was just a guy that was just sort of following whatever trail opened. And I wandered up, after I was discharged, wandered up to the state of Michigan. I don't know what on earth for. I mean, I guess there were some people going and said, go with us. I said, okay. And so I went, and here I am. And the next thing I know, I am making Buick automobiles for General Motors in Flint, Michigan. I'm always nervous about telling that. Because I'm always thinking that somebody say, when did you work at Flint? And they say, I bought one of those suckers. And I wonder why it was running sideways. That's not a source of great pride for me or them. And it was a short career. And in a city back then, the auto industry was really, really humming. And they were running buses all over the United States, hauling anybody that had enough sense to get on the bus to go up there and work. And here I am, good labor, right there available for them, and I couldn't get a job in that city. I was blackballed by General Motors, couldn't get a job. And that just wound up just hustling, and that's where I did some of what could have easily been confused as criminal behavior. It really wasn't. But I just hung out in some of those dives that I, like the one I was supposedly working in. And in that part of society, there were only two kinds of status for you. One was to be the rollee. That meant you the one that's doing the roll, getting rolled, or the roller. That means you the one that's doing the rolling. Now, I wasn't reared to do that. My God, man, I grew up in Mayberry in North Carolina. I'm not a street thug. But when you live in an environment, it's amazing how quickly you take on the characteristics of the environment, eh? And that's what I did, you know, because that's what people did, that's what I did. And it was a matter of who's friskiest on a given day. If I'm friskiest, I drink. If you're friskiest, I'll get you next. And so it's just that kind of a deal. And it's not, I still don't consider that criminal behavior. I'm not seeking out amends to any of those cats because I figure it was about a draw. I got them by as much as they got me. And that was just the way it was, you know, and so no amends involved. And so here I am. That's who I am. I'm just crashing through life. I'm in my late teens and early 20s. And it wasn't all just social disaster. What was happening on the inside was just like that fellow who I identified with, who talked about what it's like on the inside. You know, behind all of the noise and bluster, there was a fellow fighting a desperate battle. Because I didn't want to be like that. I didn't want to be the butt of jokes. I didn't want to be the guy who was a humiliation everywhere I went, who had a great capacity to end parties just by screwing it up real big. And so I didn't want to be like that. And so I was somebody who experienced that thing of just dying on the inside, just like that guy described, so that there was no hope. And I tell you, I know there's a lot of young folks here probably experienced the same thing. It's really something when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, look at yourself in the mirror and want to gag at what you see. Or to look at yourself and the best thing you come up with is, man, why don't you just hang it up? Everybody would be better off. Very true. Very true. And so that's what my life became. On the outside, it looked like a traveling circus. On the inside, that's what it was. It was a fellow who was fighting a losing battle and knows it's a losing battle. I had sort of morbidly predicted I might live to 29. I didn't think it'd go any further. Had no clue it'd go any further. And had I just continued unattended, I'm sure that would have probably been true. I was the kind of guy that had a great tendency to black out. If you drink as much as me, you're going to black out. I mean, that just happened. And I set up a pattern of just bizarre behavior where I would wake up in the most god-awful places you can imagine. And wake up, no clue where I am. Now, I went into a bar up in northern Michigan. I didn't know that I'd ever been there, but apparently I had. Because I walked in the bar, and the guy that I was traveling with introduced me to a fella. The guy said, told him who I was, and he said, I know who he is. He talked some ugly language. And he said, and I don't like him either. And he broke a beer bottle and came at me with it. To my knowledge, I'd never seen him before. But he was pretty sure he'd seen me before. And that he was going to change my looks with that beer bottle. Got through. But I have no clue what that was about. I didn't bother to get into any extended discussion with the fella. And so I let him carry that with him because I didn't want to stir it up anymore. Anyway, that was just kind of a thing. And waking up in weird places. And the heavy side of it, well, all of it is the heavy side of it. Blackouts are only funny after about 10 years. There's absolutely no humor in them when they happen. And I can remember all those times, many, many countless times when I'd come to and take a look at the latest wreckage of the past. The book describes in one place exactly how I felt when they described pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, right? And that's exactly what that would be. Not wasn't it a great party, or we must have had fun. No. It's that terrible feeling of not knowing where I am or what I've done. And you don't want to ask somebody. You know, I learned over time of just doing it so often, I learned how to wake up and show no physical evidence of waking up. Because a lot of times if you wake up too quick and you're not prepared, there'll be somebody standing over you just waiting for you to open your eyes. And they'll say rude stuff like, "Who are you?" Well, you don't want to answer that too quickly, you know, because you don't know what you might have said before. And so you want to say quiet. I got so I used to come to and show no physical evidence till I would listen for the sounds. There were certain sounds that were reassuring, like clanging metal. That always sounded good because I knew I was in the right place. And nobody ever locked me up by accident. So I knew that I was right in the right place. That felt good. But when you come to and somebody's standing over you, at first they say, "Who are you?" Or, "What are you doing here?" You hate to say, "Where?" I woke up in Alaska one time, and I love dogs. We've got a golden that just had cancer surgery Tuesday. I called this morning, doing great. Breaking me, too. We were talking about how much it cost, and my wife said, "Well, let's get it done." I said, "Now, I've got a bullet in there, brand new, and I'll sell you that dude for $1. She said, "Are you insane? You think I'm going to shoot my dog?" I said, "I'll shoot him." But I lied. I wouldn't have anyway. I want to tell you about the... I woke up with that, and I thought it was a Cocker Spaniel. I woke up to that and I said, "What is that fool doing?" I knew it wasn't in the barracks. I was in the army, but I knew that wasn't a barracks. So I looked over and I thought, "Who is this Cocker Spaniel laying there red?" I love dogs, but not on my head. And that dude was laying right on my head. So I started trying to push him off. And when I finally got my act together and saw what it wasn't a Cocker Spaniel at all. I'd done like I'd done hundreds of times. You probably have too. Went to sleep with a cigarette in my hand, and that what I saw was a silhouette of the burn that went right around the form of my body. I had one blister on my shoulder. That was it. Seconds and inches, eh? Seconds and inches. Because, my God, how many people we lose today in the state of Virginia exactly the same way? Seconds and inches, yeah. And so it was just that kind of stuff over and over. I'll tell you one more, and then I'm gonna quit blacking out. I came to one morning, I'm learning how to open up, waking up gradually. Came to one morning, and I was in a nice bed. Knew it wasn't mine. And I didn't know whose it was, but it certainly was not mine. And so I came to, didn't open my eyes, because I was hearing noises that did not sound hospitable. And so... this woman, the maddest woman I think I've ever heard in my life, was out in the kitchen yelling about, "Who is that drunken SOB in my daughter's bed?" And I just had a hunch she was talking about me. I just figured that out. And I've never been more still in my life. I didn't blink, breathe, nothing. And I'm trying to figure out how can I get out of here. I don't even know where I am. You know, I'm trying to find the exit. And finally, I saw a little crack of daylight over there at the door. And I waited till what seemed like the perfect moment. And I just leaped right out that door. Well, it wasn't as bad as I thought. It was the house next door to mine. I was kind of proud of that. My God, I usually miss it by a whole state or something, you know. And I only missed it one house, you know. My neighbor. Yeah, She didn't think much of the good neighbor policy. But anyway, it was just that kind of stuff over and over. And then I know most of y'all are well familiar that I woke up one time in a blackout that it was the worst fear of ever being realized. I woke up in jail, which was the usual. and assumed I was in there for the same as always. And then after I was awake a little while, the jailer came by on his regular round. You know, I knew the routine, and so he came by, and I went up to the front where if you want to talk to him about getting out. And made his 10 o'clock round, and so I called out to him. I said, "Hey, guy, when can I get out?" And he just looked at me with total scorn and said, "I hope never," and walked off. And I had no earthly idea what he was talking about. But I knew he was serious. I mean, he wasn't clowning around. He was quite serious. And so I was bothered by that, but I figured he just had something else on his mind or whatever. So I went back into the cell, the tank in there. And one of the guys came over to me, one of the inmates came over and said, "Do you know what you're in here for?" And I said, "No, I don't. Do you?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Last night, some guy was driving a car blind drunk up to Main Street, Saginaw Street in Flint, and struck and killed two pedestrians trying to cross the street." He said, "They have arrested you for the crime." And I tell you, that, I mean, I knew as wild and crazy as I'd been, I would not be shocked readily by most anything that happened, by very, very little. But that kind of thing was more than I could handle. I mean, I could believe it. I mean, I knew that as wild and as crazy as I was, there was no limit to what damage I could do. But that was more than I could deal with. That, because even though I was a street character, I was not a subhuman. I was not somebody who was insensitive to human life or anything like that. And so when I heard that, I just refused to believe it. I couldn't handle it, eh? You know what I mean? The mind won't take in what it can't handle. And I just could not handle the information then. And I just sort of drifted off. And my only thought was that I just want to go away. I just want to disappear. That I didn't know how to face anybody, didn't know how to do anything. I didn't even know what I'd done. But I knew that it was bad stuff. And I'll never know why, but there was a policeman there that I won't try to find out, because I don't think he wanted to be found out. He just did something as a human being, I believe, because it's not necessarily a procedure at a police. But this guy must have looked at my record, found out that I had family in North Carolina, and contacted my family. My family was my mother and sister at that time. And my family, mother and sister, did just what alcoholic families have done forever. And that's go far beyond reason. Far beyond reason. I honestly believe that the families of alcoholics suffer far more than the alcoholic themselves. I truly believe that. Because they have to live with it sober and clear eyed. They have to deal with the embarrassment, the humiliation of trying to explain unexplainable behavior. And so I think it's far more punitive for family. And so my family did just what families will tend to do. When they contacted and told me they had a guy up there in a lot of trouble, my mother's sister made a trip to Michigan they couldn't afford to try to get a guy out of jail that they couldn't afford to do. A guy who didn't even want out of jail, but didn't know how to say that to anybody. And so they came up and got an attorney that they couldn't afford to do the whatever you have to do legally to get me released on bond. And they succeeded. Yeah, I was that accident happened on the 3rd of May, and I was in jail up until the 17th of July. And on the 17th of July of 56, I was released on bond. And I knew that I wouldn't drink. It had nothing to do with alcoholism. Even though I'd been diagnosed countless times as alcoholic, I didn't believe that. I really didn't believe it. And it wasn't to do with that. It just had to do with the overwhelming weight of guilt and shame and remorse. I thought it would be impossible to pick up a drink. I just didn't understand. That rather than being the least likely, it was the most likely time that I would drink. But I didn't know that. I know that I walked out, didn't know what to do with myself. I couldn't stand to be around anybody, didn't want to look at anybody, had no conversation. I just walked the streets and wandered around all night till about noon on the 18th of July. And I started to drink, of course. And from July to November, the 19th, I drank literally like nobody I've ever seen. And that's not some idle statement. I have worked with, Al and I were talking about 12-step work. I have worked hands-on with thousands of alcoholics. Not a few. Thousands. I've never worked with one like me. I held an alcoholic in my arms while he died one day on a 12-step call. And even as he died, he was protesting that he wasn't like us. And went under. I just gave in to it. I just gave in. Yeah, and I described that young fellow that would look at himself and just going to throw up at what he sees and think that there's nothing there. And so that's what I was feeling. And then I started drinking on the 19th and stayed blind drunk. I wasn't fighting it. You know, that guy who died in my arms on a 12-step call, he was protesting that he wasn't like us. I just gave in. I just gave in. There was no fight. There was no effort. I know that some people say that alcoholism is a sneaky form of suicide. In mine, I think it was an overt form of suicide. The only reason I didn't just do myself in, I didn't want to leave a family with more feelings of guilt or remorse or whatever. And I guess I figured if I just found dead of OD or hit by a truck or something, that there'd be at least be a question. And then on the 20th of November, I finished that bottle of gin. It's three or four inches in a bottle of gin. Went off to court, and thank God that's the last drink as of this day. Yeah, my recovery started 2nd of February, but your last drink doesn't have much to do with recovery, because that was not recovery, that was just barely survival. But it was my last drink so far, thank God. So on the 20th, went into that trial, and I listened to the description of the crime for the first time. I'd never heard it described before. Nobody had any, I'm sure people asked me about it, but I couldn't describe anything because I don't know anything. And so I go into the court, and they call me to the witness stand to testify. And the hell of blackouts is there's no defense. You know, if somebody came to you and told you something you did on a given date, you couldn't explain where you were, the best you could say is, I wouldn't do that. Well, who would? Who would? And so when they put me on the stand, all I could say is, I'm sorry, I don't know. And I listened to the evidence, and I listened to the description of the crime for the first time since I'd been locked up. And I would have voted guilty, and so did they. And so I was convicted of manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter, and sentenced the same day to a max of 15 years in Michigan State Penitentiary. And, you know, even though, I mean, you gathered from that I wasn't exactly a preppy young fellow on the way to stardom. I was a real bad case. But even so, when that sentence came, and they said guilty, I expected that. And then they gave the what the sentence was. I had just a reflexive action of fear, just an instinctive reaction of fear. But it was momentary, and right behind it was the most genuine sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was over. I'm not talking about new day, or there'll be hope, or they help people like me in there. Those thoughts were not even in the society at that point. And they certainly were not in that mind. But I had that sense of relief because it's done. That was exactly the way I felt. It is done. There won't be any more. The next day, I was taken into that prison on a chain with five other guys. And I remember when I walked in there, I said to myself, this is a one-way trip. I never believed I would ever come out of there alive. I truly didn't believe it. I didn't know anything about penitentiaries. I'd always been in jails and pea farms and stockades, stuff like that. I'd never been in a penitentiary, but I knew some of the people that I was with on the street or the people that populated that, so I knew it wasn't Disneyland. And so I knew it was going to be bad news, and so I went in. I was so absolute, I was almost comatose. I mean, I was conscious of where I was and all that kind of thing, but I was almost comatose in terms of feelings or reactions or interact. I didn't speak to anybody. If they asked me a direct question, if they did, I'd answer it, but that's it. I engaged no conversation. Had somebody in a cell on either side of me, I didn't know who they were. It wasn't that I didn't care, they just didn't exist. All I wanted to do was sit in my cell and do whatever I could do to keep from thinking. That's exactly what I meant to do, to spend the days that I would be there. And then, amazingly, in that process, if anybody had ever told me anything remarkable would happen, I would have never believed it. And I'll tell you this, and I know this to be absolutely true. if it had been necessary for me to take any action to request help, I would never have done it. And it wasn't because of willfulness or disregard or not wanting something. I couldn't ask for it. You know, I was so full of guilt and shame. I couldn't ask for a drink of water. Never mind help. So if it had depended on me, it would have never have happened. But what happened, I checked in my cell, and the guy that was checking me in did a little scan of my record. The record's that thick. And it literally was not a crime per se in the whole deal. It was all drunk and whatever. Fill in the blank. If a human can do it, I was caught drunk and whatever you can do. And so he got through looking at it. He said, "Man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze." I said, "Yeah. I mean, my God, that's obvious. I've been in jail all my life, off and on, day at a time and all that." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "We have an AA group here, and I think you ought to go." Now, I mean, that was just a friendly thing. Like, if you wanted a store down here, if you want some loaf bread, go down there. It's not that dramatic. And I didn't have a clue what he's talking about. I never heard of AA. I never heard of anybody helping a drunk. Now, this, I know I don't look that old, but this predated detox, unless you want to call jail detox. They were abundant, and they were very effective, too. If you don't think jails will work as a detox, smack a cop. I guarantee you'll see how effective it is, particularly if he goes upside your head with a blackjack. That will flat detox you. But I knew that, but I never heard anybody helping a drunk. I mean, that was such a foreign concept. And he said, AA, I'd never heard of AA. Most people, now this was in 57, that the medical association had just started to nod toward alcoholism as an illness, a disease. Same view. I don't think they did that because I came in. But they might have said, "Well, there's proof positive. There's one, you know." Anyway, that's when it was. Alcoholism was just emerging from the shadows, eh? And there were 125,000 members. The day I walked in, I became 125,001. And that was my place in the deal. I didn't know that then. But this guy said we got an AA group. Didn't mean a thing. He might as well have said we've got a cavalry troop here. You might as well join that. I didn't mean a thing. And then I went back in my cell and started not thinking. And I got a note a little later, and he said, "You can go to your first AA meeting, February 2nd of 57. And in that penitentiary, that was a huge penitentiary. It was 6,300 and something guys in there the day I walked in. And I'm just one more face in a sea of tragic faces, you know, and a lot of angry faces. And that's who it was. But when you got that many people, everything is crowded. And so the reason I got that little note said you can go to your first meeting, February 2nd, you had to have a chair before you could go to the group. Because they had 300 members in the group. And so you're not going to just go in there and stand up against the wall. You had to have a seat. I guess I had one. I said, "Sit down." I did. I had no earthly idea. And I figured, I guess somebody must have told me it stood for Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is not a sexy name for a program. I swear that looks like we could have come up with something better than Alcoholics Anonymous. Sunshine Club, you know. I understand it now. But it is, if you were trying to sell a product, you wouldn't want to call it that. You know, that would not sell too well. And so I think somebody must have told me that stood for Alcoholics Anonymous. And my vision of that was it's going to be like some of that old Bible Belt, Rock and Sock'em religion stuff, you know. And I'd walked out of that stuff before I started school. And I walked out with an absolute conviction that I wouldn't go back. They drugged me in there till I was big enough to get away, and then they didn't drag me anymore. And if you don't, I'm not talking about a confused child. I'm talking about somebody who made an absolute commitment to disbelief. I never went into a church until I was 14 years in recovery. I'd go to meet at the church basement, but I wouldn't get up there where they got serious and dumped you in the tub. I wouldn't do that. And so I was really shut down. And that's one reason I'm so thankful. Good God, I'm not one of the people who wants to change the program much. I am so thankful that, you know, when I walked in, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I really didn't. And it just like I said in the beginning, it took me a long time to identify with anybody. Now I identify with practically everybody. There's better grade of alcoholics, I think. But I was blessed in that what I went into was a sound, solid group of Alcoholics Anonymous. You might have gathered, if you caught the way I phrased it, group means something to me. I'm not a meeting guy. You know, I'm not somebody who charges around and gets into every little juicy conversation I can find. Deliver me from that. If you like it, go for it. But you're not going to find me. Yeah, because I'm a home group guy. I'm somebody who believes that Alcoholics Anonymous is made up of three legacies. And if I never get beyond looking after me, I'm going to miss the whole parade. I'm going to miss the whole deal. Because it's a self-centered condition, and I just don't think you get rid of it by focusing on self. Don't believe that's the way that works. It's like that dog with cancer. He didn't just let it just outgrow him and get more cancer. He got rid of that dude. And so I'm a group guy. I'm a home group guy. I told you I belong to a primary purpose group. I am a member of that group. I heard an enigmatic definition of group one time. What does enigmatic mean? Well, it just fits somehow. But a definition of group that is two or more people, one of whom doesn't need to be present. Isn't that weird? But you think about it, and isn't it true? Like, I'm a member of the primary purpose group right here, right now. When we get out on the highway, I'll be a member of the primary purpose group. When I get on the next airplane I get on, I'll be a member when I'm right up there next to God, and I'll tell him all about it while I'm up there. A group is something I belong to. It's not something I just drop in on casually. It's a commitment. I'm committed to a group of people who have a similar kind of deal. And so that's where I do my work. That's where if there's a mess on the floor, it's mine. It's mine. I came in, I travel a lot. I came in and I've been on an extended trip. And it's just an instinct. The coffee pot was dirty. It just hadn't washed it yet. But I'd been away, so I grabbed it. I said, I'm going to wash that sucker. So I got it. I'm in there washing it. A young woman came in. I didn't know. She'd come in while I was gone. She said, why are you washing that pot? I said, my God, girl, that thing was dirty. I mean, that thing was really dirty. It needed washing. She said, that's my job. I said, now, you're going to have to be quicker if you're going to do this job. Because I just might beat you to it. But that's a home group. Yeah, that's where you belong. It's where you start to just automatically react to the things that need to be done. It's a sense of belonging. You know, I don't float loosely in the universe. I carry responsibility. That's where I do my most important work. If you come to North Carolina and you're on a Monday or a Thursday, and you ask anybody in AA, where can I find Tom I? They'll tell you where to find me. And that's where you'll find me. But that's my home group. That's where I do my work. That's fundamental stuff. And that's what I was introduced to in that institution, was a good, solid group of people who work together and for a common purpose. And it's a we program, not a me program. And so that's what happened. I had in that group, this was before we started doing stuff like taking people through the book. I never even heard that mentioned when I came in. I never went to a big book meeting first 15 years I was in AA for good reason. There weren't any. We were a fairly primitive fellowship at that point. There's some notion, romantic notion, that we used to do it more thoroughly back in the old days. If we did, they hid it from me. Because I think we do far more in terms of really helping people understand the book and doing through it. In fact, I get worried sometimes we almost make a teaching ethic out of how we work with people. And it's anything but that. But very important. You know, the finest work I've done since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous is taking people through the book. I don't do it individually. I do it by groups. And I like that. I like that because group is where we're going to live. You're not going to have a mentor for life, you know. So I don't like that one-on-one much. Yeah, I'll do a little bit of it, but not much. I like to do it as a group experience because that's where I'm going to spend the rest of my life, is in a group. I want to learn how to interact that way. Our group is strong service group. We absolutely are involved. If it's done in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's done in our own group. Every service is there, organized, staffed, and delivered. That's the kind of home group I want. I don't want someplace just to go chat and shoot the bull and boogie off. Not me. No, I want something a little deeper than that. So that's what I found, thank God, in that prison was a group that was just that way. Some of the finest meetings I've ever been to in my life were when a few of us guys, it's like any group. Now, we didn't have 300 stormtroopers. It's like any group. Every group has got a solid core of people who really hold it in the rope, who really keep it going. And then we're in various stages of repair, eh? It's just like here. You know, I'm so old, I may not even make it through the meeting. So you've got people like me. And then you got other people that are very new in the program. So it's always kind of a mix of stuff, eh? But a group is a good, solid place for that kind of a growth and development. And that's what I was introduced to there. When I back then, we didn't studiously go through the steps. We did step meetings every other week, but nobody took anybody through. What basically said in there was, do the very best you can with this. And what I did was fumble my way through. Guy told me one day, he told a group of us one day, if you'll do what's laid out in those steps as honestly as you possibly can, when you get through, you'll be a different guy. And it doesn't even matter what your motives are. And I thought, come on, man, that can't be right. But it is right, because that's exactly what I did. I fumbled my way through those steps, and when I got through, the old man used this term this morning, I had an absolute transformation. I was a different guy. I'm the same old dude. You know, I'm still look the same. I'm still 6 feet tall, all that. But where it counts, I was a different man. I had a transforming experience. For the first time in my life, I knew what it was like to breathe free. I'm locked up like a saber-toothed tiger, but I'm free. I'm free. In the ways that matter most. Tremendous feeling of being free. It's not a matter of what kind of container. Everybody here, I heard somebody say it earlier, that alcoholism is the toughest prison I was ever in. Ever. That's the one that really owns us, you know. So freedom's something we all know about, and it comes in its own way. And so I had a truly transforming feeling. I learned how to operate with dignity and honor and integrity, words I'd never even known before. And that's what I practiced as a way of life there. They called me in after only 2 years on my sentence and said they were going to consider, they called me because they were considering me for what they call special parole. Never heard of it. Nobody else ever heard of it that I knew of. But it turned out in the state of Michigan, you're eligible for parole 1/4 of your max, which would be 3.5 years for me, that would be eligible for consideration. Special parole was for what they would, every 10,000 cases, they would pick somebody they thought was an extraordinary case of rehabilitation or restoration. And they picked me. And the guy told me when I went to the chairman of the board called, he said, Tom, you probably wonder why you're here. And I said, yeah, I do, because I was nowhere near eligible. And so, and he told me, he said, about special parole. He said, we decided to consider you for you're the 10,000th guy this time. And he said, now, I'll tell you from, we've already gone over your case. We're not going to parole you at this time because the crime is too serious and the time served is too short. And I told him very sincerely what I honestly believe. I said, I agree with you 100%. Because you got to use a rule of reason, eh? I mean, with a crime like mine, there is no suitable punishment. I mean, what can you do to adequately balance between two lives and one? You can't do it. It's impossible. And so I agreed with him 100% and sincerely agreed with him. He said, what this assures is that when you come up on your first eligibility, if you continue what you're doing, you'll walk out. That's exactly what happened. I walked out. They paroled me on condition that I come to North Carolina and asked if they'd let me think that over. And I said, you know I did, about a nanosecond. And it did. I was paroled to this state. I never had really liked it down here. I had to grow up to appreciate my own home state. I had to grow up to appreciate what it was. So I hit the ground, and and went to work in a textile mill. I never did like that. Never did grow to like it either. I did. Anyway, it makes you scratch your nose a lot with that lint. But I did. I'd had a little bit in my sober periods. I'd had some successful experiences in sales. And I was a salesman of a year in a company I worked for the first year I was out of the military. Salesman of the year. Fired the same year. I was the best of the worst they had that year. And so I had a little track record. I had people offer me jobs, you know, that I'd run into people. And a lot of people in AA, they ran companies or something, would offer me jobs. Somehow, you know, when I walked out of prison, I swore to the depth of my soul that I would never go through that again. What I meant was that I'm not too tough. I'm not talking about that. That's ridiculous. What I meant was I'll do whatever it takes. I don't care what it takes. I mean that just as much today as I did then. Whatever it takes. I knew that alcoholism was my problem, that AA was my solution, so my immediate priority was to get strong in AA, and I did that the day I got home. And had an absolutely great experience. The second week I was out, some guys asked me to go to prison with them. I said, my God, man, I just got out of one. They're not going to let me in a prison. If they do, they might have let me out. And they said, that's all right, come on. It was a lot simpler back then. And I said, okay, but you better hope I get out. Or if I don't, you better hope I don't get out. And so I went. And strange feeling when you're walking in under the pretense of being there to help. 2 months later, I was named outside sponsor of that group. Now, that don't mean much if you don't know how far it is between a maximum custody penitentiary and being the leader of a service arm in a penitentiary. If you don't understand the vastness of that distance, that wouldn't mean much to you. But that's an impossible dream. A tremendous honor to be given a responsibility to take a leadership role in service. And I was honored, tremendously honored with that. Just a couple of months after I was out, my driver's license guy asked me if it wouldn't help me if I could drive. Well, obviously, with a crime like mine, driving is not in the picture. And it, on my parole papers, it had big, big letters. This man's never operated a motor vehicle. I accepted that as a fact of life. And I never would have even considered doing anything. But my parole guy said, you're real active in this AA thing. Wouldn't it help you? And I said, yes, sir, but I can't. One thing I've learned, and you believe this because I've learned it for sure, there is no wall that can't be breached, not by human power. But I believe that when God has work for me, I know this. When God has work for me to do, the walls come down. And I don't care what they are. They come down. And that's exactly what happened. And I was never supposed to operate a motor vehicle. I never even considered or even suggested that I might. I accepted that as a fact of life. The man walks up to me unsolicited. He says that to me. I went on the appointed day, went up there. He introduced me to the license examiner. And the license examiner asked me just one simple question, really. He said, told me who he was. He said, my pro guy said, tells me that you might be interested in having a license. And I said, well, yes, sir, it would help. And now don't ask me to explain it. I can't. I found out my boss doesn't go by the same rule book that we go. And the guy handed me a driver's license. He didn't even ask me if I knew how to drive. I mean, nothing. I didn't blow the horn or nothing. I mean, the guy just handed me a driver's license. It doesn't work that way. When God got work for me to do, the walls come down. And so is that one. That's not legal. I didn't even pay for it. I've been driving ever since. It's an amazing thing. I was elected DCM when 5 months after I was out. I was a DCM for 15 cities in my town. I'm the same guy who just a few months earlier had wondered if he would ever be trusted by anybody to do anything. And here's my closest second family asking me to be the trusted servant. Tremendous honor. I'd taken 2 years from Michigan State while I was coming off speed. and could study very quickly. I finished 2 years from Michigan State, so I learned how to spell DCM. And I think that was a criteria for getting elected, and so I won, hands down. And a great, great honor. And then 2 years after I was out, many of you know that. I mean, my God, I'm as at home in Virginia as I am anywhere. Y'all awfully kind to listen to old dude again. The 2 years from there, now I'm who I told you I was. Nobody else. There's no hidden agenda there. Yeah, I'm exactly who I said. And I was working in the mill on the night, on the third shift, working that thing, DCM, wildly active. Got a phone call one day from the headquarters of the prison system. And the guy on the phone was a fellow I'd met once. He told me who he was, and I remembered meeting him, and he said, "Mr. Ivester, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position." And first thing I said, just in my instinct, I said, "Do you know who you're talking to?" I'm on parole from a maximum custody institution. He's talking to me about hiring in as an official in another prison system. "Do you know who you're talking to?" He said, "Yeah, we've checked you out." Well, of course they have. Now, that's just goofy. You know? And so I told him, I said, "My God, man, I'd rather do that than anything I could imagine." To myself, you know what I said. "Ain't no way. That ain't going to happen." As of that day, there had never in the history of this planet been an ex-offender hired as an official in a prison system. And I knew that. Was well aware. I wasn't aspiring to a career like that. I would have never... I'd have thought I was drinking again if I'd have been thinking of something like that happening. But I knew just automatically that just does not happen. It never happened before. And so I told him exactly that I don't know of anything I'd rather do. I didn't even ask him if they paid for it. I would have done it for nothing. I'd have stolen for a living. But it's just unbelievable. And so I knew it wouldn't happen. But when God has work for us to do, even those walls come down. And I was employed as a rehabilitation officer, like the old folks said, in way back, 61, I guess, sometime. I can't remember that stuff. It's so old. But a long time ago. And hired. I'll just tell you this, and I'll just sum it up around this thing, something to think about. Because I know a lot of people come in, they have struggles trying to get settled in and which way to go and all this kind of stuff. Let me tell you what happened. When I went to work, I'm somebody who is deeply thankful for AA traditions. I don't just read them at meetings. I've lived those traditions. I deliberately use traditions more than I do steps. Steps become the way I live. You know, I live steps. I don't have to reach in and get a step. I live steps. Traditions, on the other hand, are great tools for dealing with current situations, no matter what they are. If you can picture, it takes some imagination now, but if you can picture a guy who's still on parole from a maximum custody institution. And now I would expect an enlightened, progressive state like Virginia to do something like this. But come on, man. We're the state that hired Jesse Helms for 100 years. And you think North Carolina is going to be a trendsetter that's going to jump out and say, "We'll blaze the trail"? No, I knew that. And so, but when that guy told me I was hired, I'm standing in a place where man has never stood. One of the guys that went on the moon is a buddy, and I've had him tell me about that experience in space. What he was doing on the moon is exactly what I was doing in North Carolina. I was standing where man had never stood. Who do you talk shop with? There is nobody. Nobody could share experience. What I resorted to were not only the principles of the steps, but the traditions. Because what they do is try to help make how we can function well within an organization, a family, a community, or broaden it as much as you like. But those traditions were absolute lifesavers. I finished up education later on in correctional administration, but I mean, all I had was 2 years of Michigan State when I was coming off speed. So it probably wasn't overly affected my mind that much. But anyway, it looked good on paper. So that I was employed, and that was I had to immediately decide, you know, well, am I going to be a hoodlum hero or a professional staff member? And there is no real decision, because the minute I take 1 cent for anything I do, it is no longer service. It is profession. And so I made up my mind very quickly, thanks to tradition, that I would go in and give it my best shot. And that I'm not going to be a hoodlum hero. I'm not going to be one of the guys. I'm going to be somebody. I'm the man. My choice is what kind of man am I going to be. And so what I did, I had a fantastic career. I mean, I could not have possibly asked for a better career. A lot of people get in prisons and they go kind of brain dead or something. They just sort of get worn out by it. I never did. I was at that just like I was with AA. I was as challenged as I still am. You know, I'm going to tell you something. It's hard to believe, but you can believe it because it's God's truth. From the day of my first job I ever had in recovery, until the last job I had in recovery, I never applied for one single job. Not one. I didn't fill out an application. I was recruited for every job I had. And I went from a rookie guy that, amazing thing to me, when I went to work, I was treated like a professional. Not a single person in that system ever discussed my history with me. I fully thought somebody would say, well, look, don't screw this up, because you'll impact every inmate in the world. I knew that. They didn't need to tell me. I knew it. But I went to work. And what I did was I gave my very best to every job that I had. Every job that I had. Because my work tells you who I am. If I do sloppy work and you can't count on me, if I tell you I'm going to do something and don't do it, that's who I am. So integrity is about being who you say you are. And so that's what I did. I gave my very, very best to every job. And then somebody would see what I was doing, I guess. They seemed to, but they'd come over and say, hey, would you do this? And I said, you going to quit, Ross? I am. And they'd come and say, if I do it. And I wound up getting higher in the system than I ever expected to be. If anybody ever told me I'd be running institutions, good God, I'd have thought they were drinking. It'd have to be. But I went through a magnificent career. Put in 39 years. Found out I was the oldest rat in that barn. And I didn't want to be the oldest rat in that barn. So I retired. And my wife tells me it's the weirdest retirement she's ever seen. I had already been elected to be the chairman of the Correctional Facilities Committee for AA in North Carolina the day I retired. So she was so thrilled when I told her about that. And she said, oh, my God, you're going again? You didn't even get stopped. And I said, well, it's only 2 years. That was about 10 years ago. But anyway, it's been just a heck of a deal. There's some people, I'll just close with this one thought. That I know sometimes you worry about it. You listen to an evangelist like me, it says, my God, you got to be a dedicated idiot to do anything. That's just not so. Some people really try to strain at how to get appropriate balance in their life. I don't. And it's not because I'm uncaring or unyielding. I mean, just like you, I've had family and finances and children and putting them through school and all of this kind of, just like anybody else. But I've been as active in Alcoholics Anonymous as any person I've ever met. And I'll tell you this, and it's an absolute truth. Nothing in my life has been injuriously impacted or affected by any of that. My wife and I will celebrate 42 years in July if she behaves. My son is a specialist in maternal fetal medicine at the University Hospital. My daughter's a psychology graduate. Now she's getting a little medical deal. Got jealous because her brother's making more money. So she's going. It's just been great. It's just been an absolute great wife. And so rather than trying to choose balance, what I recognize is that everything in my life has priorities and it has principles. My marriage has principles and my work has principles. I can't just wander off and leave my work unattended. I've got to take care of that. And so if I go by principles instead of trying to figure out what's an appropriate amount of this and how much is appropriate amount of that, if I let the principles guide me, what I find is that life goes awfully good. And I don't know about you, but I'm having a great, great time. If you're not, man, I hope you'll lay back your ears and jump on in this sucker. Thanks.